"It's a shame for such a lovely young witch to be hovering by the wall like a ghost," he said with a small bow and a flourish of his long-robed sleeves. "Would you give me the honor of a dance?" Alexandra was a little amused by the wizard's formality, but she wrinkled her nose and replied, "I think you're a little old for me. No offense." "None taken," the man smiled. "And you exercise sound judgment and are unafraid of being both discriminating and direct, for which I'm very glad. But I would like very much to dance with my daughter."
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the second consecutive week of recording an episode on time of the Remedial Magic Podcast. As always, my name is Brady, and I'm joined by my brother Baylor and our good friend Delbert. How's it going, guys?
I'm just glad it's Friday. That's all I'm going to say.
Yeah, I'm on board for that.
It is nice that it's Friday. I will say it will not continue being nice that it's Friday if I can't drag the Adobe Audition window over to the side so that I can view it and the book at the same time.
The challenges that the modern recorder faces are sometimes trying, for sure.
Yeah. Pretty annoying. I don't think that our fans really appreciate all that we do for them, frankly. A bunch of ungrateful people.
Bunch of Peyton Smiths.
A bunch of Peyton Smiths. Can you believe that guy? In the news every day, that Peyton Smith. Hate him.
What?
Ah, we trapped you. See, Peyton Smith is a character from the chapter discussion today, and you don't know who he is, meaning you haven't read the book, so...
I'm aware.
Here's Delbert being unprepared for the podcast, so...
I could probably quote you all his lines of dialogue right now, but...
Take him out of the running for your favorite podcaster.
Unbelievable.
Take him out.
It is a two-horse race.
I don't know why he would be in the news.
Regardless. This week we're going to be talking about, as always, Alexandra Quick. More specifically, Alexandra Quick and the Lands Below. And more specifically than that, Alexandra Quick and the Lands Below, chapters 26 and 27. And it's the first chapter is not super exciting, to be honest, until the very end. And then the second one's a little bit more interesting. So we have some of that going on. We're kind of getting close. We're maybe in like the last third of the book at this point, and I think there's a distinct chance we finish this book on the 1 year anniversary that we started this podcast, so that's kind of exciting too.
Yeah, it also explains why we totally took those weeks off on purpose for that to happen, right? All planned.
Yeah. It's like, I mean, that's why I took them off.
It's like tempting a ravenous wolf with a piece of meat, you know? Like, there's a manner to our madness.
Something like that,
sure.
Yeah. Something like that for certain. But before we get into talking about Alexandra Quick and the Lands Below, have you guys seen anything Harry Potter related this past week?
I have not.
No.
Seen a single thing. I haven't searched the interwebs trying to find something, but I have not found anything.
I haven't either. Apparently, Daniel Radcliffe is incredible at playing Weird Al, so that's like somewhat related.
Yeah, that's true.
But aside from that, there hasn't been a whole lot of Harry Potter action this week, as far as I can tell, and with the way Harry Potter news goes these days, that's not necessarily a bad thing for certain. However, I did want to throw out there that this is about the right time of year to rewatch the Harry Potter movies, at least in my opinion. A nice, crisp fall afternoon where you don't have to do anything but kind of curl up under a blanket and hang out with the Harry Potter movies for a little bit, that's a great time. In my opinion, and this is the best time of the year to do that.
I agree. Hopefully I'm able to do that this year.
It's more of a Christmas angle for me.
Yeah, I guess Christmas is the time ABC Family always had the Harry Potter movies on rerun, but Sci-Fi plays them during the fall, and the Sci-Fi network has a lot more credibility than ABC Family, in my opinion.
That's fine. What a terrible argument, first off. But secondly, I do have a sad bit of media news.
Sure. Is it even tangentially related to Harry Potter?
It's fantasy adventure movie.
That's all it needs for this podcast.
Yeah. Brady, you have been watching, I don't know about you, Baylor, the new Lord of the Rings show? Correct?
Negative.
I have been watching it, except for I haven't watched the last episode or two.
Ah, that's fair. I watched the first two episodes and decided that I would much rather just watch the entire extended series movies again instead of the show.
Pretty
the
bad.
The show is... I don't think it's bad necessarily, but it's kind of boring.
I told you a couple weeks ago that I think I'm going to have to wait until it's all out, like the first season, to watch it, and I think that stands.
It's pretty slow moving. Which is weird to say, because honestly, if you think about the first Lord of the Rings movie, Fellowship of the Ring, that is a slow movie. Incredibly slow, but I don't know. It just something about the scope of the movie, or maybe it's the actors. I don't know. It feels more grand than what you're getting from the TV series, at least to this point.
I also think it hurts that seemingly the entire show so far, from what I've seen, is just character backstory. And, like, sure, that's cool sometimes, but I don't know if that's what they should have spent $1 billion on.
Well, obviously, they haven't spent $1 billion on what's come out so far.
True, but...
it's part of it, but...
you know.
Was the first Hobbit movie was pretty slow as well, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I mean, when you're trying to tell such a big story, obviously, you're not going to have every little exciting detail come out in the first few episodes, which is why I say the show is good, just a little bit boring. It's because it's not like it's a bad show. It just doesn't have a lot going on at the moment. And I think it's a product of its time more so than anything else, with most TV shows and movies now being more of an instant gratification thing than a long-standing, let's follow this story all the way through type of situation. Even with Game of Thrones, which ran for 8 years and was the same kind of high fantasy type of material, you had lots of action mixed into the storytelling right away, which made the pace feel a lot faster. And Lord of the Rings, at least the new show, kind of has a lot of storytelling and certainly a lot of backstory, similar to the way Game of Thrones did, without that action piece to this point. And so I think that it feels slower because of that. Had it come out around the same time as the movies, storytelling wasn't focused so much on action back then as it is now, and so I think maybe it would have been received a little bit better. But I do think all the outcry on the internet about it has been blown way out of proportion. I don't think it's nearly as bad as people think that it is. They're just expecting constant action and not getting that, and they can't handle it.
Just to reiterate, I don't think it's bad. I just think it's going to be tough when Lord of the Rings was, the best movie trilogy of all time. Makes me want to watch that more than continue the show every time.
I will say,
I think it's just, it's mostly just a matter of giving the show more than a couple episodes before your mind has made up. That's the one thing I've noticed about this new Lord of the Rings show that's driving me absolutely insane, is people had their minds made up after watching 10 minutes of the first episode what it was going to be like, and it's not going to be like the original movies because it's not the same stories and it's not the same storytellers. It's an entirely different situation going on, and so if you want to decide not to like it, I guess that's fine. Go ahead and do that, but you have to understand that this is not a movie that's over in 2.5 hours. This is a story that's going to be told over the course of, I think, at a minimum, probably 30 episodes that are an hour long apiece. So it's a bit of a different way to tell a story, meaning you're not going to get answers in the first, two episodes of the show. It's just not going to work that way.
It's just like the series that we're talking about here. You didn't get answers in the first episodes. We had to wait clear till the
end. You might not have.
It's similar to that. Yeah, I agree. It's a matter of giving it a chance to develop, I think, and that's what a lot of people are not letting it do. And I have to say, patience is kind of limited these days in the world that we live in, because everything is right at your fingertips all the time. So I guess the people that watch that show and enjoy it for the long form that it's going to take have those patience skills developed a little bit better, maybe. I don't know.
I will say, regarding a different fantasy show, you brought up Game of Thrones, their new prequel, I would argue, is kind of slow-paced as well, setting up a lot of background. So maybe that's just the trend that these spinoffs are going off of. Spinoffs or prequels, whatever you want to call them.
Well, when you're jumping into a world, even if it's the same universe, which House of the Dragon is the same universe as the Game of Thrones series, and the new Lord of the Rings show is the same universe as the movies were. When you're jumping into a new universe or a new situation with completely unknown characters for the most part, maybe a little bit of background, but that's it, what else do you expect? There's going to be a slow buildup giving the information about the characters. That's exactly what's going to happen. You're not just going to jump in and know everything that's going on immediately, right? So, of course, that's what's happening with these shows. These are meant to tell stories over a long period of time, not in 2 hours.
I am actually surprised, though, because I think that the House of the Dragon is pretty quick moving. I mean, there's a lot of dramatic stuff going on that I don't want to spoil because Brady hasn't watched any of it yet. But we've already had 5 years of time jumps in 3 episodes, and we've had, like, a battle occur, although we didn't see a ton of it. Like, an entire war has been waged. So I kind of thought it was moving pretty quick. I'm surprised to hear you say the opposite, Baylor.
I'm not so much talking about the time jumps, because I've also noticed that, and I've enjoyed it. You know, it's keeping up with the pace. I'm just saying the action compared to the main series. Like, if you're comparing the new Lord of the Rings show, which I haven't watched, but to the original movies, they're a bit more exciting, you know, with a lot more battles,
right?
Because it was a shorter time frame. But same thing with kind of the House of the Dragon. It's kind of a... They're just dealing with a lot of the backup right, or the background right now, and just setting the stage, and then I'm sure the action will pick up as it keeps going.
I will say, my biggest thing with the Game of Thrones show so far that I'm worried about is the casting, because they do these time jumps, and there is a different cast set for our main characters, but I love the people that play the main characters currently in that show. So I'm going to be a little bit sad when they're gone and the older actresses replace them.
It'll be interesting to see how they play the role similar to their younger counterparts. Because obviously,
I mean, they look similar.
Right, right. I mean, the younger ones are obviously setting the guidelines to the character, right? So it'll be interesting to see how they continue playing them.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure I'll love it because I love the premise of the show so far, but I gotta tell you, I believe her name's Millie Alcott or something, the main Rhaenyra actress, the child actress, or younger actress, I should say. She's incredible. I love her acting. It's awesome.
Yeah, and I just want to say, too, I wasn't saying that it's like a slower-moving show because I didn't like it. I really enjoyed the 3 episodes I've watched so far.
Right.
I guess all I have to say is if you're somebody who dislikes the new Lord of the Rings show just because it's a little bit slower paced than what we've been getting in media recently, my advice to you would be to just go watch the new series so you can see what ends up happening. Or not the new series, but the old movies. So you can see what ends up happening to Middle Earth. I guess that's your quickest way to figure out what's going on, and then you can just leave the show for people who have the patience to wait out for a couple seasons and figure out what the story's actually going to develop into.
True. Or do what I'm doing and just wait for the whole first season and binge it so that you can watch all of it at once.
That's a very viable option. Absolutely, that's a viable option. That's how I watch several shows on Netflix and whatever else, but man, am I a Lord of the Rings nerd, so I am enjoying watching the new series as it comes out right now.
Yeah, and that actually ties in a little bit with Alex Quick, because I know the first time I read through these books, I read each of them, okay, I read the first two in 2 days, and then I think the third, fourth, and fifth probably took me a week or two. But I definitely wasn't reading them at a couple chapters a week like Baylor.
Oh, certainly not. And this series is kind of, I guess, maybe a good example of what patience will do, because the people that have waited around long enough to get to the fifth book that's out right now, and those of us that are about to be rewarded when the sixth book comes out sometime in the next 50 to 100 years, it's going to be a nice payoff, right? That's part of the thing with sticking with a series, even when it feels a little bit slower or you're not necessarily as interested in what's happening at the moment, is the payoff at the end is much greater than if you gave up halfway through. You know what I mean? So
I cannot explain to you how much I'm going to struggle, because it appears when we did some looking into it, or when a friend of ours did some looking into it, that Inverarity does release his new books chapter by chapter each week. That's going to kill me. I am going to really struggle to not beg for more.
That is some premium content if we can get caught up to the point where we can just do the new chapter every week.
Well, I might read that as a side project. Well, I don't know. Maybe I'll leave it for the pod. I don't know.
It's an interesting situation, but we are a long ways from that at the moment. In fact, we're 3 books and some odd number of chapters away from that at the moment. So I think perhaps we should dive right in to our main discussion for the week, which is, again, chapters 26 and 27 of Alexandra Quick and the Lands Below. And since we didn't prepare this ahead of time, I'll go ahead and do the short summary of these chapters. I wanted to remind everybody that last week we did the first part of this Roanoke arc, where Alex travels to Maximilian's home in New Roanoke to the island of Croatoa to spend spring break. And these two chapters are kind of the culmination of that arc, the second part. And it starts with chapter 26 called The Cotillion, which is where Alex, Julia, and Max, along with Miss King, of course, attend the Cotillion, the kind of the get-together, the dance that is supposed to be the matchmaking dance. And what ends up happening is not necessarily that. Instead, Alex does dance with one person named Peyton Smith, and then dances with a creepy old blonde-haired man who turns out to be her father. And I find that to be very interesting. Then in chapter 27, it's called Her Father's Bidding, and it's called that because Alex ends up seeing Maximilian sneak out of the house to go down to the forest where all the old ghosts apparently live. And so she sneaks out too, and when she gets there, she overhears a conversation, not a nice conversation, between her brother and her father, Abraham Thorne, discussing how he's not working quickly enough with whatever his mission is. And then Alex barges her way in, makes everybody uncomfortable and angry, and we kind of have a fun interaction with Abraham in that situation as well, before Alex and Max return to Charmbridge to finish out the school year. So that's kind of where we're at. And I have to say that I think the Cotillion, if it's just the Cotillion, just the dance thing, through Alex's perspective, would be just so incredibly boring to read.
Oh, yes, yes. I completely agree.
Right,
with
without
that.
All of the extra details, there's no point in reading about Alex awkwardly fumbling her way around the dance floor with a bunch of prepubescent teenage boys.
I would say,
you know what I mean? So it's nice that we get the other details as well.
Yeah, I would say that we could throw that whole dancing side of everything kind of in the same basket as this like relationship idea with these younger teens, you know? It would be incredibly weird and awkward if that's all these chapters consisted of. So I was very pleased as well that there was this surprise visit by Abraham Thorne at the dance.
not only that, but apparently it's on somebody's agenda to out Alex to all of these people in Roanoke as well, right? People that probably don't care who she is if not for her name. And so I find it interesting that when she gets to the party, somebody has changed her name on the guest list, and when it gets announced, it kind of stops the party for a moment, like, oh, wait, the daughter of Abraham Thorne is here?
Well, that's not the only indicator either. There's orders everywhere, like throughout the dance, at the entrance. Seems like there may have been some sort of security threat.
Yeah, it's interesting to me because of that. Like, I mean, obviously everyone was very surprised to see all the orders around. And then also, like, the fact that her name is Thorne or whatever. Like, okay, I understand that that was obviously not the plan by Miss King. But everyone knows who these people are, right? So really, it shouldn't be that surprising that they have a thorn in the presence, because they have three of them there, and everyone would know who the kings are as well. So I don't really know what
I think
this,
the implication.
I don't really know.
I think the implication is that people don't actually know that, at the very least, Julia is a thorn. And the reason I say that is because then later on in the next chapter, when they return to school, Max apologizes to Julia for the new round of like heckling and stuff she's going to have to take from her classmates given the new information. This chapter has made me wonder, honestly, if Julia has been so sheltered that the only places she goes is school and then the island of Croatoa and nowhere else.
I mean, it kind of...
Well, if it was Max's choice, that would be correct.
Well, I would argue that it's also Miss King that's done that, because she says so herself that she's tried to shelter them for so long, but then, you know, it can't last forever, the sheltering. So, I mean, that's why she eventually gave in for them to go to this dance.
Right, and that brings up another interesting question for me, is why would she agree to go to the dance all of a sudden? Right, just because Alex is there? I'm not really sure I understand. If she has gone out of her way to shelter Julia so that people in Roanoke don't actually know who her father is, why would she then agree to go to the dance? Right, unless somebody sabotaged the guest list, which I think is the implication here.
So you think that Miss King was behind it?
No, I don't think Miss King was behind it, but I think Miss King was anticipating taking Julia and Alex to the dance, to the cotillion, to have a good night, and not really anticipating people knowing what Alex's actual last name is.
Yeah.
Right, because at one point here, we hear that Miss King confronts the governor, or I don't know if it's the governor of the territory, but it's somebody high ranking in the territory, about why Alex's real name was used instead of the name that was provided. And they don't know. They say they're going to get to the bottom of it, but that also doesn't really explain why there's aurors following Alex around all night as well.
I guess I took a different approach on thinking through this, because I basically thought that as soon as Max leaked to the Charmbridge paper and it got out, that everyone would have known that Julia was also a thorn at that point. But I just took it as like an insult rather than an outing when they announced her as Thorn instead of Quick.
So maybe it's somebody's way of letting everybody know who Alex is so that they can all look down upon her?
Or like
instead?
Making sure, or just being, I don't know, a dick, I guess.
I don't know. Something weird is going on, right? Like, if somebody's outing Alex on purpose in this moment, then something strange is happening in this situation.
I'm of the personal opinion that they're just trying to make a dig at Abraham, I think, because like that would explain the orders being there, just in case he's there, right? And then also,
yeah, but what's
he even says himself that he told his enemies or friends or whatever political people that he knew not to ever use his kids against him, and then he did, and then they did, whoever it
maybe
was.
Maybe it was also just a warning to the people that were there. A bunch of people show up to this dance, and there's Aurors everywhere, and they're like, oh, I wonder why all these Aurors are here, and then they hear the name Thorn, and they're like, ah, makes sense.
Yeah, but what's the dig exactly? What are they trying to get back at Abraham by naming his daughter there? That doesn't really make very much sense to me.
I mean, it made their night worse, if that's all they were trying to do.
Well, that's why I was
saying... Don't you think it made everybody else's night worse, too?
That's why I was saying that it makes... It doesn't really do anything. Because people already know that Max is, you know, a member of the Thorn family. Elymas, in the last chapter, recognized Alex immediately. So it's like, people are going to know that they're going to be there, you know? I don't know.
Write in, if your name is Inverarity, and tell us.
This is the line, I guess, that makes it hard for me to understand necessarily what's happening in this chapter. It's from the next chapter, but it's where Max is telling Julia goodbye as they're going back to... Him and Alex are getting ready to head back to Charmbridge, and Julia is getting ready to go back to Salem. He just says, tells her to study hard, and if you're ever having problems, if you start hearing bad things at Salem... And so that's what makes me wonder, like, if she is known as a Thorn already, why would she only just now start hearing bad things at Salem? Or is he referencing something else entirely?
So here's my thought, and I could be right or could be wrong, I guess, but until Max outed himself as a Thorn, I don't think anyone knew Julia was. And maybe that info would have gotten into Salem, but certainly not as well as it would have after a break, like a spring break, where all the kids go home and their parents are like, you go to school with that Thorn girl? So, like, maybe it was out, but it's not prevalent until she heads back after break.
I guess that's a possibility for sure. That seems pretty reasonable, actually. I don't know. My only other thought regarding that, I guess, and maybe this explains it better than what my own personal theory does, but what if, because Abraham's at the cotillion, right? That we're going to get to that in a second. We know that he's there. What if he's the one doing it, and he's doing it out of pride? What if he's the one who changed the name so that, because he believes that Alex shouldn't have to hide from using his name or whatever? He is at the dance.
Right.
Albeit in disguise. But it strikes me that he would kind of have those sort of feelings.
Yeah, I would agree with you, except he says that it was an attack by an old political rival or something.
Yeah.
Like, he does say that.
Yeah, I guess, I mean, I know that he says that, which probably just cancels out my theory there as well. But at the same time, I think Abraham would lie to save face with his daughter as well.
True.
Well, I mean,
and it could be maybe backed up later too when he talks about how he tells Claudia that his daughter is going to leave her world and join his, as like he's gonna name her Thorn because it's the life she's choosing. I don't know. I do not know. If that's the case, Abraham Thorn is probably not happy about the name of the book.
Yeah, I suppose not, but were you surprised, Baylor, that Abraham was at this dance? Just kind of like flaunting right in the face of all these Aurors?
Yeah, I was a little surprised, given, I guess, how seemingly easy it was for him to disguise himself, because I feel like he could have easily made more appearances before, I guess, but... I don't know. That whole side of the story is continually frustrating because we don't learn anything from Abraham, and Alex kind of reverts back to the way she was when she was annoying last book. So far, I haven't totally enjoyed those scenes because we really haven't gotten much out of them.
I was just kind of thinking the same thing, to be honest. Even in this one, we don't exactly get a lot. You know, Abraham shows up and says, oh, I promised you for your birthday I would answer some of your questions. And then all it does, all he really does is kind of go out of his way to be so frustratingly vague to Alex that she gives up and walks away from him.
Yeah.
I also would like to take an official stance for myself here on the podcast. Whatever is used to make Polyjuice Potion should be highly, highly regulated. Like, it makes sense that Abraham Thorne could get it, but it's a pretty big problem that Hermione was able to, or... It is such a powerful effect to be able to just sneak in as someone else, and all these, like, law enforcement officials are in the room and still can't do anything.
Well,
Polyjuice is OP.
Not only that, Polyjuice Potion is so strong that J.K. Rowling just completely quit being creative after she invented Polyjuice Potion. Polyjuice Potion became the out for almost every major situation that we saw, especially going to the seventh book where Harry leaves the Dursleys under the effects of Polyjuice Potion, right? They sneak into the ministry under the effect of Polyjuice Potion. It's just Polyjuice Potion everywhere. Polyjuice Potion is like the golden snitch in the wizarding world. If you have it, you can do anything.
And I think the golden snitch is the golden snitch in the wizarding world.
It's interesting. The ingredients of Polyjuice Potion are fluxweed, not grass, so I'm assuming things that grow in the wild, lacewing flies, you can get that in the wild, I assume, leeches, definitely get that in the wild, a piece of the person you're turning into, and then the two things I don't know are horn of bicorn and boomslang skin. So I don't know if you could even regulate that, because assuming those are also pieces of wild magical creatures, I think people could just go out and get them themselves.
All I'm saying is that potion is strong. Very OP. S tier.
Absolutely. My thought, if we're talking about muggles, like our world, the stuff to make, you know, explosives or various drugs are regulated, right, at stores. But you're still able to buy a small bit of it. Like a small personal amount that you wouldn't be able to distribute these things, right? And so I guess knowing the muggle world, if that's the case, the wizarding world probably A, doesn't even care who buys this stuff, or B, you know, is doing the same thing as us, and you can get enough to make Polyjuice Potion for yourself because they're assuming you're not doing that.
It's just like Felix Felicis, right? Like, if Felix Felicis is a real potion that just makes everything go right while you're under the effects of it, then it makes no sense for either the Ministry or Dark Wizards to not have a master potion maker constantly coming up with a supply of Felix Felicis, right? Unfortunately, it is the way it is in literary works, but it's something that was written into the stories that was kind of an oopsie daisy, because it's also like a universal problem solver. You know what I mean?
It's definitely like a Pandora's box, right? They opened it and now they don't know how to close it. So
right. It's the same thing as the time turners in Harry Potter. It's the same concept, right? You wrote it in and now, oops, shouldn't have done that, because all of a sudden that's a solution to all the problems, you know?
Yeah. So they just get blown up in the next book. Or the two
going back to this conversation with Abraham, though, him and Alex start dancing, and he, I guess, has some magic that makes it so that the people who are listening to his conversations don't hear what the actual conversation is, which that's pretty cool. I don't know if he's just saying it's just like muffliato or something a little bit more advanced than that, but the nice thing is that while it's not a very satisfying conversation, we do see him take a more of a proactive stance in this conversation than maybe he has in the previous ones. You know what I mean?
Yeah, he definitely tries to move the conversation along, I think. I enjoy how he, like, is nearly about to explode because Alex is the most annoying person ever. And then he's like, I have shown you great patience, young child.
Right. I actually think that's pretty good writing because it's kind of like, it's like akin to what you see in movies that focus on the cartel, where like the leader of the cartel shows good humor until you reach a certain point and then all bets are off and he snaps. You know what I mean? And you can kind of feel whenever Alex and Abraham talk, you kind of feel that building a little bit. The tension is increasing a little bit every time they talk because she's very pushy and he wants her just to kind of shut up and be a kid and listen.
I wonder when that'll end, like the whole Alex is just a kid thing, because I would argue that she's acting much more like an adult than a kid, just the way she's written, but I don't know.
Whenever she talks to her father, she definitely doesn't give him any excuse, right? She doesn't give him any leeway to... She doesn't, like, accept his kind of mediocre answers that are meant to just push off her questions until the next time. She definitely calls him out on that stuff, and a great example of this is where Abraham is talking to Alex here about how Claudia... The reason she doesn't like the wizarding world is because he gave her a chance to see it and then told her she can't be part of it because wizards and muggles don't mix. And Alex takes that to mean, so you're the reason why my own mother doesn't like me and won't talk to me about my life. And I don't necessarily know if that's the truth, but from Alex's perspective, I feel like that is probably the realest feeling she's had, you know?
Yeah, I tend to agree with her too. I mean, if that's really the case, then yeah, I would say Alex is probably a painful reminder of Abraham and the world that she can't live in.
I also think during this whole conversation, when Abraham Thorne is talking, I can't help but just envision Tywin Lannister from Game of Thrones, going back to that. Because he's, like, really blunt with his answers, but he's also, like, calculating how much to tell and stuff like that. And it just, like, it feels like a way that Tywin would talk. Like, my patience is running thin or whatever as he's starting to get annoyed with her or whatever. So that's a tie-in from earlier, but that's the character vibe I've been getting from him during this conversation.
I think that that's a pretty apt description of him in terms of who... he might act like in a different type of media, just because Tywin, as you're saying, humored his children, humored the people that were beneath him for a time until he ran out of patience. And we see Abraham do that here at this point. But Alex throws it back in his face. He's like, hey, I've been very patient with you, Alexander. And she's like, yeah, well, I've been patient with you for 12 years, buddy boy. And then she just storms away. She doesn't really give him a chance to respond to that. And I have a feeling that Abraham doesn't have a lot of people in his life that don't just bow to his wishes. You know what I mean? It might be only Alex that treats him this way. And so I wonder how off put he is or how off balance he is made by Alex reacting this way to him.
I mean, I think it's... like, he even, or I guess Inverardi even wrote that Abraham, like, looked away from her because she was kind of putting the pressure on. And Inverardi said that it looked like he's not used to doing that to people because he's used to being in control and in power and stuff. So I'm sure it's definitely a different perspective for Abraham, yeah.
So Max definitely knew that Abraham was going to be there, right?
Oh, yeah.
He had to have known.
I think he knows everything.
As soon as Alex storms away from Abraham, Max is there to, like, comfort her and ask her if she's ready to go home. You know, he says, have you had enough of dancing? And I guarantee he said it, like, in a sarcastic, is the job done now type of way. You know what I mean? Max is just, I don't know, he's obviously not fully honest with Alex either. Not very many people are, but Max is definitely the inside guy, right? The evidence just keeps mounting, and it mounts even further towards the end of this chapter where Alex gets home. Her and Julia talk a little bit about who they danced with and how much fun it was. And then Julia goes to bed, and eventually Alex falls asleep, but she wakes up when it's still dark out, and she knows, she looks out the window and she sees a silhouette kind of leaving, and she knows that it's Max because she can recognize, because she knows that shape intuitively, meaning the silhouette of Max. And then she casts some doggerel verse so that she could jump out of the window, and it works, right? She jumps out and lands on the ground, and she takes off after Max into the forest to the place where she's been told not to go, where she's seen very violent ghosts fighting with each other. And so we're kind of getting away from Roanoke here a little bit and back into reckless Alex mode. So she can see what Max is up to.
True. She's a spy.
Yeah, this was the most surprising way that she got into the forest. I figured that just curiosity would get the best of her after seeing the ghosts, and she would end up in the forest. So I think Amber already did a good job writing this part. So.
Well, and what do you think Max was going into the forest for at this moment, Baylor?
Well, I figured it had something to do with Abraham Thorne, because Alex first saw Hagar, which is obviously Abraham Thorne's familiar, flying into the forest, and then saw Max running in after it. So I definitely thought, oh, Max is going to meet with Abraham Thorne.
Yeah, it's like really the only option, I think. I don't think Max is going to go join the war battle reenactments that are happening out there. I think he's probably going to meet with his father, because Max seems to have the most contact of the children with his father.
This is one of my favorite scenes of the book so far, when she runs into the ghosts.
That's pretty cool, right? It's very interesting, right? She does go to the forest, and one thing I liked about this is Alex uses Charlie in a way that I actually associate with familiars, kind of. Like, asking Charlie to lead, to go do something for her and then report back, which I think is a really cool use for Charlie, especially if she can start doing that a bit more often. But she makes her way into the forest and runs into the ghosts, and I don't know if these are the same ghosts or not. These could be the colonial ghosts that were fighting the Native American ghosts, or maybe not, but they are the ghosts of Abraham Thorne's dead ancestors, which is pretty fun.
It's an interesting idea, because it shows us that both Abraham Thorne obviously grew up on the island, or I guess not, maybe not on the island, but New Roanoke, because his family's from there. And also previously we figured out that the Governor General was also from New Roanoke. And so it's interesting to me, because maybe they knew each other before they both were political giants.
That's a possibility for sure. I mean, this definitely lets you know that this area, maybe this whole homestead, was the Thorns first, right? And Miss King inherited it because Abraham was off being a delinquent somewhere. I'm not really sure, but the ghost that Alex speaks to specifically is named Absalom Thorne, and I have no idea. He is Alex's great, 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 great grandfather. And he's not very pleased because he's been kicked out of the family crypt for the night so that Max can meet with Abraham. And so I like the idea of a ghost who's just like fed up with what with what his descendants are doing and is annoyed because he can't get his night's rest.
It's also hilarious. Well, maybe not hilarious, but very interesting to me that Abraham Thorne is so nervous and so paranoid that he kicks his own family ghosts out of the crypt so that way they won't overhear what they're talking about and then report to the inquisitors.
The other thing that I like about this is it diverges from what I thought about wizards, in that if this is colonials and Indians, right, like this is like 1600s at the earliest for like the arrival of the European families. So even if you assume that this Absalom guy was one of the people that came over from Europe, that means that in the family, they've only lived to roughly 60 or 70 years old. Whereas I'm pretty sure Dumbledore's like 130 and McGonagall ends up being over 100 or something like that. So it's interesting to see that their lifespans were not nearly as long as we've heard from in Harry Potter.
Well, you know, us Americans have pretty low life expectancies. So compared to those Brits over there, you know, we're about half.
I do
want
maybe the American, maybe the American wizards have a lower life expectancy than the people from Britain. I guess that's a possibility. But I'm also wondering, do you think wizards in the 1600s would have allowed themselves to be subjected to colonialism, like to being shipped away on slave ships and or colony ships over to the U.S.? I don't necessarily know that that's the case.
I find it...
Well, I don't want to get too deep into the history of that stuff, but we were certainly raised with a very favorable opinion of the people that were removed from Britain and sent over to the Americas. From what I understand, it was more so that the Puritans that made their way to North America were upset at the government for not being more religious and having more punishments based on their beliefs than the other way around.
Well, sure, but I still don't think that the wizards would have allowed themselves to be subjected to the same conditions.
Maybe, but I also doubt those conditions were very difficult when they can just summon a 4,000 square foot tent anywhere they go.
I personally find it hard to believe that they would be in a place like this, like back then, by choice, or I guess not by choice, excuse me, because, I mean, they're a wizard, right? A witch or a wizard, like they have pretty good, like they can take care of themselves if they need to. Like they could go live in the woods if they don't like their government. But honestly, kind of a dark reason as to why they came over, I feel like they thought it was maybe a lawless place because there was no wizarding government set up. And so it was a place that they could be whomever they wanted to be, albeit bad or good, whatever, and not get in trouble for it.
In the context of the wizarding world, I just don't think wizards necessarily came over at the same time as Muggles. To be honest, in the context of the wizarding world, wizards, at least, at the very least, think that they're much, much smarter than Muggles are. And so, because of that, I have absolutely no issue believing that wizards probably explored much of the world prior to Muggles doing so. Right,
that
and so,
right.
Who knows? There's a possibility for sure that the wizards, that the Thorns were in America established prior to the rest of the colonists arriving, even. Do you guys think it's interesting that the Office of Special Inquisitions interrogates even the ghosts at this place?
I mean, they've got to be looking everywhere, right?
It shows me that they're desperate, that they don't have anything on him. It, like, if they're returning to a place that he's lived in the past and his family is dead at, like, they're really stretching the limits, I guess.
I mean, to be fair, though, he is here. So
oh, no, absolutely.
Maybe I mean, they have some intel.
It's a great idea. I'm just saying, like, you know, a family member ratting out another family member? I don't know.
Yeah, can you force a ghost to tell you the truth?
I don't know. They can't drink Veracitarium?
Veracitarium?
There you go.
Like, you can't force them to tell you the truth that way.
You probably can't torture them, right?
I have no idea. You can petrify them with the gaze of a basilisk.
You can banish them.
But even under threat of banishment, how do you know they're telling the truth? That's an interesting point. But it doesn't matter as much as the conversation between Abraham and Max that Alex ends up overhearing. It is confirmed without a doubt now that Max is on a mission for his father just as much as he's on a mission for the WJD. That is without question. Right. What's interesting is that apparently his mission from his father includes getting close to Mr. Manuelito, like working into his inner circle or something of that nature. And so does that confirm that our theory that John Manuelito is just a poser is wrong? I think it kind of debunks that theory a little bit.
I mean, there's obviously something more at stake, right?
There's got to be. There has to be something more at stake, and it sounds like Abraham Thorne is desperate, kind of. Max hasn't done what he was supposed to do, and there's only 2 months left in the year, and we see Abraham sort of fly off the handle for the first time in this section because of that, and I just think that that's an interesting thing to bring up, considering Max to this point has been telling Alex that the reason he's still in the Mors Mortis Society is to make sure they're not doing anything too dangerous, you know? But it sounds like his father wants him to do the exact opposite and is to become friends with them to find out what they're doing.
I'm confused. I'm not necessarily confused. I'm just, like, this kind of... There's a lot here that hasn't been answered because we don't... The two main people in the story up to this point has been the Governor General and Abraham Thorne, and they obviously are enemies of each other. But then we have this John Manuelito guy who, if he is someone of significance, is a part of a different family or a different group that is somehow either enemies with Abraham Thorne or he's trying to become allies with. And so, like, there's a whole nother group of people or ideas or whatever you want to call it that hasn't even been accounted for until this point in the story.
I mean, possibly. I think perhaps you're overlooking one of the central themes of the story so far, and maybe it's not necessarily John Manuelito that matters as much as finding out what he knows that matters. You know what I mean?
Right. I'm just saying, like, I don't know. Because if John Manuelito is in the Mors Mortis Society, he probably isn't friendly with the Governor General. I think that's safe to say. And so, like, I can't tell if the information he's trying to figure out is someone against him or someone that he's, or something that he's trying to gain. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I understand what you're saying. It's interesting to consider. There's a lot of things converging at the same time at this point in the story, right? Because you have this new information that Max is supposed to be getting close to John Manuelito. And we also know that John Manuelito is the one who supplied this coin that takes people to the lands below, to Darla. And so I just think that maybe Abraham's motivations don't necessarily lie with the person John Manuelito, and instead would lie with his interest would lie with anybody who has that same information that John must have, that he's giving to Darla, right?
If that's the case, though, then why doesn't Abraham Thorne just approach John Manuelito?
Well, because Abraham can trust his son not to tell anybody that he showed his face.
Right, but, like, I'm pretty sure we called the Mors Mortis Society, like, the emo group a while ago. Imagine if the most important emo kid at your high school had Billy Joe Armstrong of Green Day walk up to him and ask a question. He's probably going to tell him whatever the hell he wants to know. You know what I mean?
Well, we don't really know if John Manuelito has any unspoken allegiance towards Abraham Thorne.
Maybe not, but, I mean, dark recognized dark, right?
Only if motivations are the same, I think. I think that's the difference between good people fighting with other good people, like on the same side as other good people, just because they serve good, right? I think that if you're on the dark side, then you're going to do whatever serves your motivations the most, even if it means betraying other people who are, quote unquote, on the dark side.
I have a horrible question to ask of you two.
Okay.
When I first read this, and as I'm reading it again now, I keep getting a upsetting feeling about what I'm seeing, because I first see Max and Abraham talking, and Abraham talking about how Darla is able to get close to John, and Max saying, well, I don't think he swings my way, but you want me to try? Followed by a long period of silence, and then Abraham basically says, well, maybe if Alexandra. Is he pimping out his daughter? Is that the intention there? Because that's what I took away the first time I read this for sure. And I was like, wow, what a scumbag.
Yeah, maybe, to be honest. It's within the realm of possibilities more than I would like it to be.
Right.
I think Abraham kind of thinks of his children as tools in a toolbox more than...
That's what I think.
As children, so it wouldn't surprise me.
Cool. I agree with that part. I don't think that he is trying to pimp her out because, I mean, he's talking about kind of how clever she is and all that stuff. So I think that maybe he's meaning like Alex would be doing a better job because she's more innovative and would find a way to get it done.
Yeah, I think that too. I mean, I think what you're saying is more likely, but it's really hard to say whether or not Abraham truly cares for his children or if he's currently seeing them as a way that he can get back into the running for whatever he was trying to do before he had to go into hiding.
Yeah. I definitely agree with you about him using them as tools for sure.
I'm still unsettled.
Well, Abraham Thorne is unsettling as it is. You're talking about a man who is putting his children in even relative danger, like danger of being expelled, whatever, and then when they're not able to succeed, even though, what's Max, 17 at this point? 16, 17 at this point? Even though they're still young and don't have a lot of experience, acting like his plan falling apart is their fault because they couldn't do what he asked them to do. And it's not as if Max is wholly incapable of things. He's a pretty talented young wizard, but at the same time, Abraham's asking him to infiltrate a society full of people who are suspicious by nature, right? Who are constantly looking out for things by nature because they're about to get in trouble all the time. So he's just kind of he's obviously a user, right? He's not somebody who's in it for the best interests of his children. He's like Grindelwald, sort of, in terms of doesn't matter who I hurt on the way as long as what the outcome is for the greater good. That's like the feeling I get from him.
It would make sense with that logic why he isn't giving Alex answers. Because he's wanting Alex to continue to be curious, which makes him relevant in her life. And so basically just lengthens the period of time that he's able to try to convince her to be on his side, I think.
So the other thing I find interesting is it seems like in this chapter we get a bit of confirmation that Abraham doesn't look at Julia the same way he looks at Alex and Max. Julia doesn't even seem to have any idea what's going on, and he's not going out of his way to meet with her anyways, so I wonder if he just doesn't see the potential in her that he sees in the other two, or if she's just not been with his plans before necessarily when they've met. I don't really know, but her lack of involvement in these situations is interesting to me.
I mean, Abraham says it himself. He says that he didn't think Max's assessment of Alex was correct because she isn't like my other daughters. So I definitely think that Alex is definitely the top of the list regarding dealing with this stuff. So maybe all the other sisters aren't too involved.
Now, I will say that Abraham does, in this chapter, commit some terrorism. At least it's implied that he commits some terrorism. And I say that because Max and Alex get ready to go back to school, and they go to the Wizard Rail Station, and we find out that there are travel restrictions that have been imposed on all Wizard Rail and Port Key transportation. And it's because the governor of Roanoke and a lot of his staff and most of the Aurors who were watching over the Cotillion are suffering from ghost sickness, which, according to Max, ghost sickness is just a cover story for what happens when somebody does something that they don't want people to find out about. And in this case, I think the implication is that Abraham cursed a bunch of the people at the party.
Yeah. In response,
Abraham's kind of a badass.
I think it's in response to the changing of the name thing. Because he said that they were going to pay, and I think that they paid.
Well, it could be that, but it also could be that he's just an ass, to be honest. Like, you say he's kind of a badass, and I agree, he's probably very talented, but here he's cursing countless innocent people who are literally just doing their job because he thinks he can. You know what I mean? Like, this is a pretty clear indicator that while he might be not the person the Governor General says he is, he's not necessarily a good person.
I mean, I think I threw that out there with the possibility of pimping out his daughter. So, no argument here.
Well, sure. But this is a little bit more concrete proof of that, right? Like, the fact that he is willing to just do this because of that, you know, make a lot of people's lives worse because of that is enough to paint him on the dark side for me for now. You know what I mean?
An official pro-Governor General stance.
Definitely not a pro-Governor General stance, but Abraham Thorne makes me feel more anti-Abraham Thorne all the time.
Agreed.
The chapter sort of ends with Max and Alex getting into a bit of an argument about her wanting to again be involved with whatever mission their father has set for Max. And it's kind of the same conversation as always. I think maybe she gets a little bit further. He seems to be a little bit more understanding of her desires to be with part of the plan by the end of the conversation. But I have to tell you that there's one point in this conversation that's more troubling to me than all of the rest of it. And it's when they're talking about how Dean Grimm or Diana Grimm or the WJD is not above using Legilimency or Veritaserum on Max and Alex to try to figure out what's going on. And Max tells Alex that he has a different potion that he can take if he thinks he's going to be dosed with Veritaserum, and it reacts badly with Veritaserum and makes it look like he had a Veritaserum overdose. So am I to understand that Max is carrying around the proverbial cyanide pill?
Is it proverbial, or is the overdose deathly? Like, will that kill you?
I think that's the implication.
I think it just is a cyanide pill.
Like, so not only is Abraham having his son, his 18-year-old, 17-year-old son, do this, he's also prepared him to commit suicide in case he gets caught.
Yeah.
I think that is insane.
When you put it that way, it doesn't sound very good.
Abe's a bad badass shithead.
Yeah.
Can I go with that?
He's a bad, comma, ass. That is crazy. And again, it makes the pressure on Max's shoulders seem very, very heavy.
Yeah, I guess it all comes down to what a reaction to a Veritaserum overdose would be, right? I mean, obviously the implication, since it's like secret agent stuff, is that he would be committing suicide, yes, but...
I mean, maybe it just gives him disgustingly magical diarrhea.
I mean, I think the only really explanation is that it kills him, because if you overdosed on Veritaserum and it didn't kill you, you would still have to tell the truth. Right? So maybe it's designed so that it looks like the WJD poisoned a young wizard trying to get answers and to make them look bad, but I think it's much, much more likely that it's the cyanide pill situation. And then the chapter kind of ends. It does end with a closing thought of Alex's. She promises not to do her father's bidding to Max, but it's like a half promise, sort of. At least it feels that way, because she promises that she won't do her father's bidding, but whatever she is going to do, she's going to do it because she wants to, meaning that if she wants to do her father's bidding, then she's going to do it. And if she wants to work against him, then she's going to do it. And it just is a promise for trouble, to be honest, going forward.
Max is stupid. That's my take from this chapter.
Yeah.
He gets caught, gets tracked, gets overheard, which that's on Abraham too, this powerful wizard that can't tell that a 13-year-old girl is listening in. But additionally, he says, or she says, either trust me or obliviate me. And he doesn't take the second option, which sounds honestly like a pretty good option.
Yeah, but it's his sister, you know, so it'd be kind of tough to do that to her, I think. Something you just said does make me wonder, and we do need to kind of get into our extra segments here a little bit, but something you said does make me wonder if Abraham knew Alex was eavesdropping and he's sick of Maximilian's shit, so he wanted her to know what was going on, right? Because she's much more of a doer than Max is, it seems like.
He, like, kind of prodded her to want to be a part of it again, is what you're saying.
That's kind of what I think is going on, yes.
Yeah, I agree. One more thing before we move on, just one quick thing. I kind of did some research real quick on Veritaserum, and it looks like even if they get a confession from Veritaserum, this is actual from the Harry Potter wiki, that the testimony is only partially credible because the answers might be true to the mind of somebody who has taken Veritaserum, but are actually factually false. And so, potentially, maybe a Veritaserum overdose just makes you go insane. And so, like, you're just sputtering nonsense, basically.
I think potentially, but I also think it's probably, based on what we know, it's probably not past the Governor General to look past that little complication, you know?
I mean, it's the same thing as a polygraph, right? Like, it can give you a pretty good idea of what's true and not, but it's not 100%. Correct.
Right.
No, I was just saying, like, for an overdose, it either probably makes him go insane or it kills him. That's what I'm trying to say.
Either way, it's not cool, man.
Yeah, definitely not cool.
It's not cool. With that being said, though, that is the end of this little section of chapters and is the end of our 5-chapter arc with Roanoke. So let's do the arc MVP.
I forgot about these segments entirely.
Baylor, why don't you go first?
That's excellent, because I'm sure that this would be a popular pick. I went ahead and went with Miss King. And the main reason is that she's a badass, first off. And then she just makes Alex feel loved for being who she is. And we see at the dance, and also before they leave, that she's kind of a voice of reason for Alex. Like, she can command authority from Alex. And then also, she's a pretty cool mom. So that's why.
Yeah, I think she's awesome. I think she's awesome. I really think she's the mom Alex needs, to be honest. She might be a lot more like Julia if she had a mom like Miss King. Delbert, who's your ARC MVP?
I'm going to go with Alex quick. Surprise. I mean, obviously these chapters have focused on her kind of figuring out a little bit more about who she is and what her heritage is and all this stuff. But at the end of the day, that last line is what makes her the MVP to me, where she says, I'm not going to do his bidding. I'm going to do my bidding. And if it aligns, cool. If not, cool. So it's cool to see a 13-year-old that's, you know, that in control of themselves.
Yeah, I liked Alex in these two chapters quite a bit. I thought she made choices and decisions that really reflected her and not like an insolent 12-year-old. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I definitely appreciated that line because she said this before, but after seeing everything and being involved with her father in this plan of his, the fact that she's still saying that is a good character sign for her.
My ARC MVP this go-around is going to be Abraham Thorne. So kind of rounding out the trio there, I'm picking Abraham here because while I just went on a rant about how it's clear that he's not a good person, his ability to infiltrate a Confederation-sponsored event where there's tons of Aurors around so that he can talk to his daughter, I think shows off how powerful of a wizard he is and just how far behind the Confederation is. As well as, I finally got to see Abraham acting like the kind of authoritative head of a criminal organization you would expect from him when somebody's disappointing him. And so while I don't approve, I'm glad he's not letting Max off the hook, right? Because that would undermine his character if he did.
Fair. I like it.
That sounds good.
He does seem a little bit mafia boss-ish in this chapter.
He certainly does.
Yeah, especially because he has an assistant. Completely forgot to mention that, but definitely
he does have an assistant, Zachary.
That's the guy that he was polyjuiced as, correct?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, but he was the guy who grabbed Alex.
Right.
So,
Baylor, what did you rename this arc?
You know, I struggled with this one. Obviously, we're going back to both the previous episode and this episode. But I named the arc New Roanoke's Revenge. And the reason being is because we have the Thorns, obviously Abraham Thorne, and everyone doesn't like him. And this was kind of, presumably, it makes it seem like, the first opportunity for the New Roanoke people to kind of get back at Abraham Thorne by, you know, being rude to Julia, changing Alex's name, etc.
That works for me. Delbert?
I am extremely proud of this since I just came up with it. An utter disappointment. Alex thought she was going to be disappointed by the dance, but instead she started to have fun and then was disappointed by her father. And Max is also an utter disappointment to Abraham, it seems.
Yeah,
so,
apparently.
I like it.
I decided to rename this arc going back five chapters to Flying Horses and House Elves.
Okay.
That's fun.
I wanted to think of defining features of Croatoa and Roanoke, and the flying horses certainly, and then the house elves as well. We learned quite a bit more about in this arc, and I like that. So yeah. Flying horses and house elves.
It probably fills a little bit more because mine only focuses on really the end of it. But I still like that because she seems to have such a good time in the beginning and then there's just so much shit at the end of her vacation.
Yeah. I guess the next thing we need to do is we need to cast somebody, and we should have done it during the discussion, but we didn't. So, Delbert, why don't you lead us into that?
That's okay. If we're going to cast Julia, then we better cast Miss King as well. So that's who we're casting today. Who wants to start off?
I can go, I guess.
I'll be happy to if you want me to.
Yeah, go ahead, Brady. That's fine.
All right. For Miss King, I'm picking Jamie Lee Curtis.
Okay.
I looked at her, actually, as mine as well.
The reason I'm picking Jamie Lee Curtis is because I think she can play that authority figure, and I have certainly seen movies with her in it where she plays like the authority figure who's also very understanding and kind and polite to people who are not necessarily part of her crew to begin with.
Right. I like it.
I think that's fair.
Baylor, how about you?
The reason I looked at Jamie Lee Curtis is because I looked up, what was that word, Junesque or whatever? And that just literally means an imposing woman. So Inverarity said imposing woman and Junesque appearance. So kind of doubled it up, Inverarity. Maybe you want to look at that when you're having your beta readers read. But anyways, no, I'm just joking. Anyways, Jamie Lee Curtis was on this list, but also I went ahead and went with Katie Sagal, I believe. And the picture on this website was very imposing, so that's why I went with her. She also had long black hair, so there's a qualifying feature.
Oh, sure. Yeah. I can see it. I guess that just leaves you, Delbert.
True. And it's interesting because both of these people were people I looked at for this. However, I went back and went with my original thought, which is Jennifer Garner.
Sure.
She looks nice. I'm sure she can play a nice Southern lady who at times can take control of the situation, especially like she does at scenes in Dallas Buyers Club.
Yeah,
great movie, and she has a great role in it.
She also has brown hair, which is an important feature of Miss King because she's the only person in this entire universe with brown hair.
Is Julia's also black?
I have no idea. Julia was brown and Miss King was black.
True.
Oh, well, excuse me. But regardless, I think that that's a really good option as well.
Yeah, nicely done.
Yeah. Dance. I like all three of those, to be quite honest. Good session, boys.
All right, Baylor, it has been a while. It's been like literally 5 weeks since you made this prediction, so I'm very excited to hear it. But would you please play your prediction from 2 episodes ago about these 5 chapters so that we can give it a score?
For my prediction, Alex will head to Croatoa with Max, I believe that's what it's called, to spend the Easter holidays with Max and his family. Alex will learn about the 2 cultures that Brady mentioned. 2 or 3 cultures, I guess. But if it is 2, I think it will be the Roanoke people and the old colonials. Probably meet some bigots while she's there. And then finally, Alex will once again be contacted by Abraham Thorne and potentially do some of his bidding for him in the form of a mission.
All right. Well, we just heard your prediction, Baylor. And again, I said you made that prediction a long time ago. I had completely forgotten the entire thing. I want to toss out there that she did indeed go to New Roanoke and Croatoa with Max.
She also did learn a little bit about cultures because of Max talking about how some people would be snobby based on different ideologies.
Correct. She did get contacted by Abraham Thorne again as well. I don't think she necessarily received a mission from him.
Or did she?
But it was kind of implied.
Eh?
I'm going to give this a 6 out of 10.
Okay.
I was lower than I thought.
I was thinking 7, but I thought I was going low. I'm going to stick with 7 because I think it was pretty good, but it was also lackluster for knowing it was for 5 chapters.
You didn't necessarily peg the details. You got the big ideas, though. So
yeah,
it's a 6 for me. It's a 7 from Delbert.
That's fair, yeah. I had no idea what was going to happen. I mean, 5 chapters is a freaking long time.
It's a lot, yeah. Go ahead and mark that score down, Baylor, and then ask us a couple questions for your prediction for next week's episode about chapters 28 and 29. Chapter 28 is called Wizards in the New World, and chapter 29 is called By the Magic on Your Kind. Very helpful chapter titles.
Yeah, not at all. Yeah, I do. A couple questions for you guys. Delbert. Does Alex learn of Max's plan in the next chapter?
Unequivocal yes.
Brady, does something happen regarding Darla and or Manuelito in the upcoming chapters?
Unequivocal yes.
Great. Excellent.
The most yes I can possibly make a yes.
Alrighty. Let me think of my prediction here. Give me a second. Okay. Sorry. Took a couple minutes there. Because I have nothing, absolutely nothing to go on. So I just decided to throw some paint on a wall and see where it stuck. So we'll pick right back up where we left off. Where we left it during chapter 27, and Max will be telling Alex all about the plan that Abe has given him. Basically, Manuelito has ties to Abe's enemies, and he is using Max to try and find out what they have against him. Max is appearing to work as a government operative, so that way it shows Manuelito that he can be trusted. AKA, he's against his father. In other news, Darla attempts to go into lands below and fails miserably because Alex stops her. And this time, Alex gets the last laugh. Dun, dun, dun.
Excellent. So you've predicted that Alex will kill Darla in the next two chapters. That is exciting.
Oh, no, not kill her. Just stop her from getting in the lands below.
That's the same thing at this point.
Yeah, I'm going to count it as killing her for the prediction purposes.
Wow, okay.
Well, that's a great prediction. I'm excited to see how well you do next week. And with that being said, we are out of time for this podcast, both because it's gone on too long and because we're about to be kicked out of the recording studio for the night. So I've been Brady.
I'm here.
And I've been Baylor.
And we'll see you next week. Good night.
Good night.
Good morning for those of you living on some other coast.